Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Jesse Simpson. Jesse is a Marine veteran turned entrepreneur. Jesse runs a company called Action Oriented, which helps people rebuild their lives after trauma or transition. And his journey is one with the theme that it's never too late to transform your life. So I'm excited to have you on today, Jesse, and chat about your story and your background and how you got to where you are today. So welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Scott, for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Jesse Simpson. I'm a Marine Corps combat veteran. I served 4 years in the United States Marine Corps, and I served 5 years as a firefighter in the state of Arizona. Currently, I'm working now with men to help them own their powers so they can stand as pillars of strength and security in their family and community. And, you know, I left the fire service about 4 years ago, and my life has taken a wild ride. But it was the military and the fire service that really made me and provided a structure for me to step into this role that I'm taking on now. And I really believe I'm grateful for these opportunities to connect with other veterans like you, Scott, and to share our stories with the world, because I believe that the veteran community is the warrior class of our generation. And right now we are being called to step up and continue our life of service for our families, our communities, our country, and the world around us. So I'm grateful to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that you're here to share this story, because I totally agree that, I think stories like yours and the stuff that you're doing can really have a positive impact on the veterans that are out there. So let's take it back a little bit and let's talk about how you ended up in the Marine Corps. Was this like a childhood ambition? Were there others in your family that served or how'd you end up in the Marines?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for me, my journey takes me back to my childhood. I had a really troubled childhood. I dealt with a lot of anger and anxiety, a lot of disconnection to my family. My single mom was raising her four kids. My older brother had cancer during the time. So it was a very hard time growing up. My mom filed for bankruptcy twice. When we were growing up, we were struggling financially. My mom was emotionally bankrupt and she was projecting all that onto her kids. So me as a young boy, when my dad left when I was seven, you know, just took a lot of the weight on that. And I felt completely disconnected, completely unloved, completely alone in my family, in school. And I started to act out a lot. So I'd get in trouble for smoking weed, cussing out teachers, skipping class. And I was, you know, deemed at risk, troubled youth, all these sort of things, these labels I was given. But one day in the summer of 2001, I got in a fight with my mom. And, it was just like the last straw for me. I was completely just like a broken little boy. And I went upstairs with a butcher knife and dug it into my wrist, wishing I was dead. And I realized, you know, I felt responsible for the sadness that my mom was experiencing from the turmoil she felt with her business, the things were going on with my older brother. And I just felt responsible. And I was just like, you know, I'm just going to end this for myself and for the rest of my family, put us all at peace. But I had this moment of clarity up there after I was digging this knife into my wrist, when I realized that if I were to do this, I would be even more responsible for more of my mom's sadness. And I saw a picture of her coming up and like seeing my dead body upstairs in my room. So I stopped, I put the knife down and just kind of covered up the marks in my wrist and just went about my life. And then there, I was going into seventh grade that year. And it was then September 11th, 2001, I was sitting in a seventh grade reading class that morning, unsure of what it all meant. And really it was that day that changed the trajectory of my life. It gave me a sense of purpose, a calling to serve something larger than myself. Of course, I didn't have those words to describe it at the time, but it was because of that, because of what I saw happen when the firefighters from New York City ran into the Twin Towers with complete disregard for their own safety in support of complete strangers, that helped me shift the things, the focus from myself, the pain that I was feeling, to the idea that I can serve other people and it can bring value to my life and the world around us. And then I saw about the Marines going in overseas when the war on terror kicked off. And I thought about how badass it was to go over there and fight for freedom. And so it was just as hard as that time period was for me, it's really what gave me a sense of purpose. So ever since seventh grade, I'd wanted to be a Marine and a firefighter. And it was that September day in New York City that started it all for me. I continued to get in trouble a lot, but I cleaned it up just enough to graduate early from high school and join the Marine Corps. I went off into the summer, graduated early from high school and went off in January of 2007 to be a United States Marine.
Well, that's an interesting journey that you took. And I like how you talked about how you had that moment of clarity that, you know, your mother would end up having even more pain and more suffering if you went through with what you initially set off to do. And I think that's an important thing for people to realize is that, you know, while you might end the pain for yourself, it's really not ending it. It's really transferring it to somebody else. And I think that's an important thing that some people are they don't really think all the way through when they're setting off on something like that. And I think that was, first off, I'm glad that you had that moment of clarity and thought about that. But I also think that it's an important message to spread to other people as well, that, you know, just because the pain that you're going through is seemingly ending for you, it doesn't mean that it's ending, and it's really just being transferred on to your loved ones. Nobody wants to do that to their loved ones. That's not what anyone is setting off to do. We want to make things better. We don't want to make things worse, right? So while you're in the Marines, what was your job in the Marines, and what did you do while you're in there?
Yeah, so I was super motivated coming out of high school, went to all the MEPS things, signed up my junior year, had to get my parents to sign me up and stuff like that. And I remember when I went in the first time, I was like, I want to be infantry. And I went in there and there's this staff sergeant recruiter, and he had his dummy, big mannequin dummy with all his like combat gear on it, like knee pads and elbow pads and all these things, and it looked really badass. I learned later on that, at least from my experience, the grunts were wearing a bunch of knee pads and elbow pads. That's not what we really did. But it was funny going in. This dude played this moto video like of Iraq when he was there, you know, showing like dead freaking Taliban or whatever was going on in that video. But either way, it was super motivating. I went in there and I was like, I want to be infantry. And he's like, you want to be infantry? I was like, yeah, I think so. He's like, you think so? And he got on my ass about thinking that I wanted to be infantry. And he's like, if you think, there's no way you're going to be infantry. And I was like, oh shit. Okay. So it kind of pushed me up there a little bit and really started to help me own that a little bit. But yeah, man, I was always wanted to be infantry. I really felt the call to serve in that capacity. And so I went in as a infantryman, and I ended up being an infantry machine gunner, choosing the machine gun route in the School of Infantry. And that was my thing. I served 4 years. As troubled as I was as a kid, I had a lot of energy, a lot of focus, and I was just missing structure and discipline from my childhood because my dad wasn't around as much as I needed to, and the military really gave me that. So I excelled in that environment, and I started to I was grown as a leader. I was meritorious, promoted twice. I was named Marine of the Quarter at one point. I was pushed ahead and made a squad leader ahead of all my peers. And there's a lot of for me to learn as a young man developing as a leader in these situations. I got to go on 3 deployments. The first 2 were MEUs, where we floated around basically Southeast Asia. We sat in the Gulf of Yemen for a while and conducted security patrols kind of things. You know, they told us we were there in case anything were to go down. But really, we just traveled to the Philippines, Thailand, Japan, Malaysia, and we're there serving like operations outside of Yemen in 2009 when there were some things going on there. But it wasn't until on the way back from that deployment, Anybody who served, from at least from my experience, you know, during the time of war, knew, at least in the Marines, infantry, you know, you're planning on going to war. And that was, we were all super motivated, and they were always telling us, you know, prepare for this, because that's where we're going. Even up to like the day before our Muse, even while we were on the Muse, they were saying, we're getting ready to go into Afghanistan. So I think that's just a thing to kind of keep you triggered and alert and focus on what you need to do. But we kind of lost a little bit of hope. We were coming back towards the end of our second deployment in 2010. And a lot of us were getting out, and we were going to miss our opportunity. So to serve really at the highest capacity in combat. And then in like February 2010, on the way back from our second deployment, they were doing that big push. They were doing a big push, a troop surge in Afghanistan. So we had the opportunity to voluntarily go to Afghanistan really right after our second deployment. And we came back and we had like 3 weeks. We had 1 week of leave, and we had 2 weeks to get our shit together and pack up and go to Afghanistan. So I spent the summer of 2010 in Afghanistan, in Marja, Afghanistan, serving in combat and really sort of fulfilling this, this intention to serve in that way. And man, it was so different than what I thought it would be. I'm grateful for having the opportunity, but it was one of the most challenging experiences of my life. That's the answer to your question. So we can keep going wherever you want from here.
Yeah, sure. And I think that change in environment and the that structure and discipline that you were lacking as a kid, you might look at someone who is in high school who's getting in trouble all the time, right? And you might look at them like, okay, well, this person might not amount to much in their life, right? But really, at the end of the day, it could just be something like what you're talking about. It could just be that they're lacking that structure, the discipline, that rigor in their life to give them an environment where they're going to succeed. So, when you join the Marine Corps, obviously a very structured environment, that was an environment where you were able to excel and succeed because you had that structure that you were lacking. So I'm looking at that story and thinking to myself, like, someone might be quick to judge someone like yourself who was in high school, maybe getting in trouble and things like that, quick to judge that person and say, oh, that person's just not going to amount to much. And we might even do that as adults too. We might look at someone who's just in the wrong environment. And they may have the ability to succeed, but it's really just helping that person find that right structured environment so that they can succeed do what they're fully capable of doing. So I like that you pointed that out.
Let me hit off that a little bit, Scott, because I think you're spot on. And I want to say, like, for me as a kid, and I think all young men, what we need is that structure, whether it's coming from sports or martial arts or something like that. And we need a masculine presence. And because my dad wasn't there, he moved away. I lived in Iowa. He lived in Arkansas. I only saw him every once in a while. I didn't have that masculine presence, fortunately for me, also in seventh grade. And so I acted out. And I wasn't getting the attention, the direction that I needed as a young man, which all young men need. So I acted out. It's a natural, you know, process that I was experiencing. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I felt like a complete failure. I was a total failure. I felt absolutely worthless as a kid. I felt like everything I said was stupid. Everything about my life was like failure, 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 and everything on the outside. And I continued to create situations and experiences in my life that reaffirmed that feeling of failure that I had inside. And, it was something, it was like divine intervention for me, because 9/11 had a huge impact on my life. That was in seventh grade. And then just a little bit further into seventh grade, I was actually introduced to a man that I really believe saved my life. His name was Mr. Blue. He worked in my school as a juvenile court officer. He was like a former Kansas City Chiefs football player, a big dude. And he became my first mentor. And he didn't do too much other than just provide a little bit of structure. He'd take us to the YMCA to play basketball. I lifted weights with him for the first time. Like, he was just there. His presence was really what kind of gave me a little bit of that like I didn't want to get in trouble anymore during that next year and a half, because I would miss the opportunity to go to the YMCA and play basketball. So that structure, that presence of him, Mr. Blue, really saved my life, you know. But it was an interesting time. I remember in eighth grade, I took a tour of the downtown juvenile court detention center in the town where I grew up. It was like a scare tactics sort of experience. Like, you're going to end up here if you don't get your shit together. And I was down there with two other boys, like seventh, eighth grade boys. And at the end of that tour, we went and sat in front of a judge, and the judge lectured us for like 30, 45 minutes. And then at the end of it, he pointed at the first boy. He said, "You'll be dead by the time you turn 18. He pointed to the second boy, "You'll be in jail." And then he pointed to the third boy and he's like, "You have the chance to write your own story." And I don't know what happened to those other boys, because Mr. Blue got laid off not long after that. And then my freshman year, I ended up getting kicked out of my house. I left that sort of environment behind. I don't know what happened to those other boys, but I always say, like, I've been given a chance to write a new story for my life. And as tough as it was as the kid to experience these things, I know that they were exactly what I had to experience so I could step into the leadership roles that I'm stepping into now, step into the things I serve, that push, you know, to become a Marine and these sort of things. So I just wanted to say that, yeah, the structure is so important. And us now me looking back as a man, like, showing up for a young men in my community in whatever capacity that is so important for ourselves and for the next generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. I think that that structure, having that masculine presence, you know, I think all of that is super important for people growing up, the young boys growing up to show them, really have that kind of a role model or something to emulate in their own lives, so that they are they're having that positive influence, so that they become good men when they grow up as well. So I think that's super important too. So after your time in the military, kind of fast forward a little bit here, like everyone else who gets out of the military, right? You had this transition period where you got out and had to figure out what you wanted to do with your life. So what was that transition out of the military like for you?
Yes, that's a great question. So for me, well, it was incredibly difficult. I'll start there. I have a beef now, really, with how we separate from the military. But my experience of it, like, I went from my second deployment, 2009 to 2010, went to Afghanistan all of summer of 2010, got back fall 2010. And then I was scheduled to get out like 2 months later from the Marine Corps. So I had like two and a half months between serving in combat and then being unleashed on the civilian world. And my experience of separating from the Marines was, and this was, you know, 2010, basically. So 12 years ago, it's crazy. But, it was, we're basically being coached into how to become victims and identify with things that can get us money for the rest of our life. PTSD, ring in the ears, these sort of aches and pains that we have. And, you know, again, I didn't have this perspective on it at the time. I was like, oh shit, you know, everyone's doing this. We should try to get as much money as we can. But that was my experience. And that was my like plan when getting out of the Marines, was to try to collect as much disability as I could, collect as much unemployment, which is another thing they coach us into, getting unemployment checks, and then going to community college and collecting GI Bill and just trying to collect as much money as I can while sitting around smoking weed on the couch. And I tried that for the first like 2 weeks when I got out of the Marine Corps, and I started to get really depressed. And I started to fester a lot, like getting really anxious and angry, and like, you know, all these emotions that I have been suppressing from my childhood, from serving in combat, these sort of different things started popping up. And so I started to struggle a bit with a lot of, a lot of the anger. I was like yelling at my roommates and causing problems, and definitely anxiety, which I didn't know what it was at the time. Substance abuse became a thing for me. And I went into like more party drugs and these sort of things. And I just started to like party a lot. But I had an opportunity when I was going to community college, which my plan was still to become a firefighter. So I went I was going the EMT paramedic route in community college, still with the intent of becoming a firefighter. And I had while I was struggling with this sort of stuff, trying to navigate my my internal emotional experience and like being around a bunch of people who didn't understand. Like when I got out of the Marines, it was because I was like jealous in a way of like my friends and family who were back home, like living the college life and partying on the weekends. And I was like, damn, that sounds like awesome. Maybe like leave like forever. And it was just, I remember going home on leave and how amazing it was, you know. But I got there and I'm like, man, these civilians are turds, you know. They just sit around and do nothing, and they have no sense of purpose or direction in their life. And I was started to feel very disconnected from my friends, like my high school friends that I went back to hang out with and these sort of things. So it was a very challenging, confusing time for me. I got an opportunity, one of my teachers who started to serve as like a mentor for me when I got out was also a yoga teacher. So he invited me for a yoga class one time, like six or eight months after I got out of the Marines. And that was like the first time I like ever did anything like that, where I like was able to like rest my nervous system and connect a little bit with my body and stop living from the head up so much. But I still kept partying and doing my thing, going to school and really struggling to find my way. But then in January of 2013, I was fortunate enough to go on this volunteer trip to Lima, Peru and work at an orphanage. And I went down there with this idea that I was going to help these kids, you know, these kids who had nothing. They grew up in this really poor area, one of the poorest districts outside of Lima, Peru. I was going to go down with my American privilege. I was a Marine Corps combat veteran, all these things, you know, this whatever. I'm going to go down there and help these kids. And after 2 weeks of playing and teaching and working with these kids who had like sticks and balls and dirt to play with, but they had the biggest smiles I'd ever seen, it was clear that they started to shift something inside of me. And they started to open my mind a little bit to the idea there are so many people back in the States who have everything materially that could ever desire, but they're deeply unhappy. Yet these kids have nothing and they're the happiest kids I've ever seen. I started to question like my upbringing and what I thought was important in this life. And it really shifted my values in a way that, well, it really served as a turning point for my life. So that I went on with from my time down there in Peru, where I was able to go, I went down there with this idea I was going to help these kids. And I came back with the understanding that they helped me, they changed me, and they pushed me on this path to continue my service after my time in the military. So for me, that meant becoming like a youth mentor, just like Mr. Blue was for me. I worked at a grief camp for kids. I served as I did like a bunch of volunteering hours in the oncology playroom at the Phoenix Children's Hospital. And so I started to like get a sense of purpose after my life and after my time in the service by living a life of service in the community. And that was really amazing for me. It gave me a lot of direction and focus. And then I kept moving forward. At this point, I moved to Arizona, and my intention was to become a firefighter. So then in 2014, I was picked up the Mesa Fire Department in Mesa, Arizona. And, you know, my childhood dream job. I felt though all this time, a lot of like the anxiety still present, but I didn't really know it. I didn't have any self-awareness around it. I was just like, I'd have times where I couldn't catch my breath for like no reason. And I didn't realize what it was until later. But either way, you know, I became a firefighter and it was my childhood dream job. I felt a lot of imposter syndrome for sure, but it's kind of funny looking back because I got picked up and I was like looking around and there's a couple other veterans, like an army officer, a couple guys, a couple corpsmen, I think. And these different people were in there and I was a badass dude. Like I had my bachelor's degree. I had served in combat. I was a Marine Corps veteran. I had all these volunteering experiences, but I looked at these other guys and put them on pedestals and really didn't think I was worthy of the job. And now it's clear looking back though, that was just all stemming from my childhood. This lack of worth that I had, I was continuing to carry that with me throughout my entire life. So yeah, I got with the fire service and I'd love to talk about that, but I want to bounce it back to you, Scott, and make sure I'm not, if you got any questions before we move on.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I think, you know, so that volunteer experience, I want to just circle back to that. I love how that experience where you were going down to go help out these kids and volunteer with them with the intention that, okay, I'm going to help somebody else, right? And you end up having this experience where you realize that these kids are actually helping you probably more than you're helping them. Not to diminish what it was that you were doing for the kids at all, because I'm sure, you know, obviously I wasn't there or anything, but I'm sure the work that you were doing down there was important stuff that they needed. And I'm sure that they're very appreciative of the type of stuff that you are doing for them. But, you know, I had a similar experience when I was in Afghanistan. I was actually in Afghanistan 2010, same time frame that you were in there. And some of these kids that you see there, they had nothing, like absolutely nothing. Like you're saying, they had balls and sticks and stuff. Like that would be a stretch for some of these kids to have something like that to play with, right? And they would run up to us and ask us for like a single pen, and then they would fight over it to like see who would end up getting that pen. Like that was like how little they had. They didn't even have a pen to write with, if, you know, in school or whatever. They had nothing. But you'd see them playing with trash sometimes. Like they'd just be kicking a can, like a soda can or whatever. And they're happy. They had all that they cared to have. They didn't care about having the latest iPhone or the, I don't, you know, some of them probably didn't even know what an iPhone was, right? And so they didn't care about any of those things. And I think that's an interesting thing to look at with these kids, is that you don't need all these material things to be happy. You know, it's really an eye-opening experience when you start to realize that you can be happy without all this crap in your life, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about your time in the fire service. And first off, what brought you out to Arizona? Was it for the job out here that you ended up taking, or did that did you just end up out here, you know, following some other volunteer experience, or what happened there?
Yeah. So when I got out of the Marines, I went back to Iowa, which is where I grew up. That's where my friends were. I went to community college there for 2 years. That's when I went to Peru and these sort of things. But pretty much like a month after I got back to Iowa, I was like, why the fuck did I move back to Iowa? I lived in California. It was sunny. Like there's no winters, like cool people, like go to the beach. And I just went back to Iowa and I was like, man, such a bad decision. I could have stayed in California. But so really I decided, along with that, I was on the trajectory for a 2-year paramedic program, but I was having too much fun. And I was like, no, I'm going to use my GI Bill and go for a full 4 years of school. And then when I was considering schools, I was like, I want to go back to California or move to Arizona. I had heard good things about Phoenix and Arizona State University. And it just worked out that I ended up going down to Phoenix to go to ASU. So that's really what took me down there. I was seeing a girl at the time that her sister lived there. There's a lot of things just lined up and it made sense for us to go down there. And so that's how I ended up there in, I think, 2013, that summer, and started going to ASU. And I just by chance, I really just heard about this city of Mesa, which is right outside Phoenix, hiring for a fire department. I had my EMT, which is a requirement. And I was down at ASU doing all the volunteering and stuff in Arizona. So it was really just for school. And while I was going to school, before I even graduated, actually, is when I got picked up with the Mesa Fire Department. You know, it was really interesting for me because like it was like truly my childhood dream job. It was like everything I had ever wanted. And I got the job, and it was interesting meeting these people who had tested for 5, 6, 7 years to get into the fire service. It's very competitive. Like I think we had like they took 2,000 people in the test, but they only hired like 40 or something like that of that list. And, wow. And you know, so it's really competitive. It's a good job on the surface. You know, you have good benefits, you know, it's, you have time off, you all have all these different things. And I was really drawn to it, not really for those things, but because I was totally driven because of what I saw on 9/11 and really because of what I thought the impact I would have on the community was. And then I got in the fire service, and I want to preface what I'm about to say with the fact that it is absolutely imperative that we have men and women that are standing up as first responders, firefighters, police, and otherwise in their community. And I left, so I'll get into that, but it was for a reason. And really what I started to find that instead of really helping people, like going on like fires and motor vehicle accidents, I found that the vast majority of the calls are mental health in nature, ranging from drunks and addicts in the streets to suicides and overdoses in people's homes. So of course we do help people, but the vast majority of these calls are just things that are, well, they're not fires, that's for sure. And in fact, 3% of the calls are fires. You know, so we are going on fires less than 3% of the time. 80% they say are medical, and I would say 80% of that 80% are mental health related. So I just started to realize that, you know, I was perpetuating this broken system where we are picking up people who have a mental disorder of some kind, whether it be PTSD or some other sort of like bipolar or some sort of alcohol dependency, or, you know, or overdoses, you know, these sort of people. And it's interesting when you see someone who's blue in the face because they've taken a bunch of, or they've overdosed on heroin, or it's really eerie when you walk into a garage and there's a 28-year-old man hanging from the rafters and his mom's trying to pick him up. Or, you know, when you see somebody who shot themselves in the head and you're cleaning up the mess, and it's like their sister is the one that found them, you know, and she's outside bawling in the front yard. So I really got like, man, like, what are we doing here? This is ridiculous. Cause we'd send these people who needed help, like to the hospital. And like, if you're suicidal, let's say suicidal threats, you go to the hospital for 3 days, they put you on like this mental watch, they probably give you a bunch of medication, they pop you back on the streets, and there you go. Now you have a lifetime of medication. And it was just a really disheartening, very frustrating experience. You go on the same people day after day, and there would be no resolution to what was going on. So I started to get really frustrated with that. Frustrated, really angry. You know, at this point now, I've been out of the Marines for a couple of years. I started to lose people to suicide that I serve with. And, you know, I could relate with that because of my time as a kid when I was suicidal. And I'm like, what are we doing? We're not helping these people. So for me, it really drove me, because of my time after the military, getting involved in volunteering as a veteran, it really gave me a sense of purpose. And I knew that if I could bring this to other veterans, that we could start to create a ripple effect where veterans can have a sense of purpose. And me coming from the troubled childhood, when a mentor saved my life, we could combine these two people together and have like a solid connection between people who need purpose and people who need someone to be there. So I created this nonprofit after graduating from my undergrad that was structured around a leadership and resiliency training program for at-risk youth, with the follow-on mentorship components with veterans. And I was like, man, this is it. This is like my life purpose. This is it. And I was even planning, like, I could build this nonprofit up and I eventually be able to retire from the fire service. So I didn't have to like keep doing this bullshit. We're not really helping people. And again, I speak general when I say we're not really helping people, because we do help people. Like, there were times that we were able to kind of bring people back who had a diabetic problem, or, you know, got them out of like serious like car accidents, or there was a couple of fires, you know. But, you know, I've done like chest compressions on like 50 people that had cardiac arrest, and zero for 50 of them came back. You know, every once in a while you'll hear a story about somebody who came back, a younger guy who had a heart problem and went down, and firefighters brought him back. And it's a beautiful love story. And you hear about those sometimes. But I mean, my experience on the ground was overwhelmingly frustrating, because I really was not making that much of an impact. So Conflict Complete, the nonprofit, really serves as an outlet for me to start to build something that I could really make an impact on my community. And I got a lot of momentum coming off of that. And this was like 2017, spring of 2017. And I was featured in the newspaper a couple of times. I was on a handful of podcasts. I got an all expense paid trip to Texas to this veterans boot camp program. Like, I was feeling really on purpose in doing this stuff. I was going to meeting after meeting on my days off. While I was not busy on calls at the fire station, I was sending emails, making calls, like building websites, just freaking going for it. I had no idea what I was doing to start a business, but I just knew this is something that was really important to me. But really, I was starting to wear myself down. Like, I was on one of the busiest ladder trucks in the country. Ladder 201 in Mesa, Arizona was the 16th busiest ladder truck in the country in 2016. And that's where I worked. And so we're getting up, you know, 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 or 7 times a night to go on calls, most of which are just like drunk people or just ridiculous calls, people fell down or whatever. But either way, it's really disruptive to sleep. And I just kept pushing through. I was taking Adderalls during the day to kind of keep me focused and moving forward. I was smoking weed at night to bring me down. And kept going forward on that. But it all built up. You know, I started to get noticed that my hard work and determination to build this. I was talking to people. People started to notice what I was doing with this nonprofit. And I had made a lot of different connections in the community and started to be recognized. Like, people were in the fire service were talking about it. And really, all this energy culminated in September of 2017 is me being recognized as the Arizona State Firefighter of the Year. I had built this nonprofit while working on the job and also went out of my way on a call to help a veteran who had PTSD. Went completely out of my way to help this guy, basically. And that was, people heard about that. And I was recognized, and I was nominated for and then awarded the State Firefighter of the Year. I spoke in front of hundreds of firefighters at the State Fire School, talked about leaving a lasting legacy. And I talked about a man named Patty Brown. Patty Brown was one of the first responders to the World Trade Centers on 9/11. And he and his crew went up there with complete disregard for his own life and was responsible for saving hundreds of people's lives. But him and his crew all died that day. And he is a man that really inspired me, that gave me that sense of direction. I didn't know his name at the time, but I just did research on 9/11. I was like, man, like, Patty Brown is the guy. And yeah, so I had this sense of purpose in September of 2017. I was a firefighter of the year, speaking in front of hundreds of my peers about legacy and purpose and living a life for others. And then about a month later, all of my shit caught up with me. And my brother, who had cancer at this point for like 20 years, he got terminal pancreatic cancer when he was 14 years old, when I was like a little boy, which started that all when I was a kid. But he was living throughout this entire time. But there was like this roller coaster of like, he's getting better. Oh no, he's getting worse. And it'll be like years where he's kind of like in remission or whatever, and then it'll come back. And it would get worse. So he had been getting worse again around this time. I had some personal other family things going on. And, around this time, my best friend from the Marine Corps died of a heroin overdose. And that really hit me hard. Here I am going on heroin overdoses on the fire service. And it's reminding me of my best friend, Paul, who died a few months before. The last straw for me was then in October of 2017, there was a machine gun shooting in Las Vegas, Nevada at a country music concert. And I was not there, but that really struck me at a soul level, really deep inside of me. And I was just devastated because I served as a machine gunner in combat. I've shot machine guns at other people. And I did it, I believed at the time, because I was preventing that from happening here. And that was not the case. So I felt like my whole life was a lie. It wasn't worth it. I was sick of all this mental health stuff. There had to be a better way to help these people. And now the freaking ultimate, a machine gun shooting at people just like me, because I love going to music festivals and these sort of things. People just like me enjoying their freedom here in the States. And it was all these things piled up, and I just crumbled into this deep depression. I pulled the brakes on the nonprofit. I stopped, canceled the board of directors. I told everyone I can't do it anymore. And I just spiraled into this very low place. I was deeply depressed. My girlfriend at the time, we were fighting all the time. I was like, I would go to the gym, which was really my only escape in a way. I had used that as my like physical release ever since Mr. Blue taught me how to lift weights. So I built myself into a big, strong man. But I would go to the gym and I'd sit down and I'd just cry. And I would have to leave, and I would go home and lay on the floor and just cry. And, you know, this went on for a few weeks. And at one point in there, I was the firefighter of the year and I was smoking weed at work. Obviously that's not okay. And that was my reality. I was so deeply depressed. I was so deeply unhappy. I was smoking weed at work. And then a couple of weeks later, I started having suicidal thoughts. And then I realized that I was having the same suicidal thoughts as a 28-year-old man, the firefighter of the year, as I had when I was in seventh grade. And I was the same seventh grade boy internally that was broken, alone, disconnected, angry, anxious, unsure, lost, all these things, this same experience inside, despite the outside looking so successful, I knew in that moment that if I didn't break this cycle, that this was going to be my destiny, that I was going to either kill myself or I was going to get into harder drugs, or I would be miserable in this job that I was starting to really hate and resent and have to look forward to retirement, you know, 20 years down the road. So that was my experience in the fire service. It really pulled me through the mud in my life and forced me to face myself. And what that meant for me, ultimately, when I was sitting there, I had this, I remembered my time in Peru. And I remember the richness of that experience and how meaningful it was for me and how it gave me and pushed me on this sort of path to service. So while I was struggling through this time, this very challenging time in my life, I thought about South America. I thought about how real it was to be there and live that way and like how I wanted to be something like that. So I was talking with my girlfriend at the time and we talked about like selling all our shit and going to travel and going to Peru and all these sort of things. But we had a career and we were living together. She was going to school herself. Like, it's not easy to just like pack it up and leave. But December 31st, New Year's Eve, going into 2018, I spoke it into existence. And I said, I'm going to Costa Rica. I was telling some other firefighters, we were kind of bitching about the fire service and just like how we're frustrated about it. These two other guys, one of them also actually ended up going to another department. But I was like, I'm going to Costa Rica. And I declared that day, and I had no idea what I was going to do, but how I was going to get there, what was going to happen. But over the next 6 months, I started selling all my stuff. I worked it out with my girlfriend at the time to figure out how we could make this work. We sat down to figure out what we want with our life. And we tried to basically determine our values and our goals. And like, we're aligned. What we want to travel the world. We want to go to school. We want to do X, Y, Z. And we're like, we can do this. We are meant to be together. If we're meant to be together, we'll find a way. And so we did. We sold all our stuff. I sold all my clothes, all these things that I had. I sold my car. And then June 26th of 2018, I took a one-way flight to Costa Rica with no real plans of ever coming home. And I left that experience of being a firefighter, that old identity, that I was so patriotic, but I started to lose that connection to that. I left it behind. And I went to Costa Rica with no real plans of ever coming home.
Yeah. And So that's the start of this journey. But you ended up not just traveling to Costa Rica. You traveled several other places around the world as well in this journey. What prompted the change of scenery, change of location, and where'd you end up traveling to, and what was your experience like in this this journey?
Yeah. So. The plan was to go to Costa Rica for a couple of reasons. My wife, my girlfriend at the time, she had never been out of the country before and she was scared to go anywhere, but she had some friends that had recently been in Costa Rica, so they kind of talked her into that. So we went down there, and really my plan, backing up a little bit, was to go to grad school. So I was using vocational rehab to go to grad school online. So I could travel, and I was getting a master of global management degree, so I could travel and also learn about the world from like my own experience, but also like the global business perspective while going to ASU's School of Global Management. And that was really my plan. It was also in this time when I decided to become a coach, so I could really be of service to others in their time of need. And that started actually back in January 2018. I was like, I want to help people. Like, I'm sick of like this BS on the fire service where we're not really helping people. Where it's kind of, I felt like I was just perpetuating this broken system. I was like, I want to help people at a real grassroots level. Like, me and you, let's figure this shit out so you can take back your life and overcome the adversity that you're experiencing so you can create a life of your dreams. Cause I really believe that was possible. And I still do. And I'm still on this path, but it was then I became a coach so I could be of service to others in their time of need. And my plan was to do grad school while we were traveling. So really I felt like I jumped off a cliff with a parachute, like hang gliding, and on this sort of journey, this travel, this leap of faith that I went on, I had no idea where I was going to land. sometimes I would be cruising. It was beautiful and amazing. And sometimes I was getting thrown around in the wind, you know, and just torn around. I had no idea what was going to happen, or things got bad, or we got our house broken into, my laptop stolen, like whatever, you know, all these things were happening. But really, we just trusted it. We trusted the journey and we just took it one step at a time. Sometimes we didn't know where we were going to be, you know, three nights from now. And we always ended up where we needed to be. So we went from Costa Rica. I ended up living there for 4 months. I worked at a surf camp in the jungle for a month. I could go into a lot of details on all these stories. Obviously, it was a very rich experience, but Costa Rica was just an incredible place. It was incredibly, the beaches are incredible. I got an opportunity to sit with a medicine called ayahuasca at an ayahuasca retreat there. That really served as a powerful transition point from this sort of old life I was leaving to this new life I was starting to create. Opened my eyes to this idea of unconditional love and interconnectedness to all things. And still didn't. Yeah, I mean, it was very powerful for me, and that kind of pushed me on some things, helped me realize a lot about myself. Let's see. And then after Costa Rica, I had always, since my time in 2013 in Peru, wanted to go back to Peru. We talked about hiking Machu Picchu, which is an ancient ruins in the Andes Mountains that is a pretty popular tourist attraction in Peru. But I convinced my girlfriend to go to Peru, and we're going to hike Machu Picchu. And we stayed up there for a month in the Andes Mountains, working at like a lodge in a tiny town in the Andes Mountains in Peru. And we hiked Machu Picchu, and it was just a really cool experience. And each country we went to, Costa Rica, Peru, and everywhere else, gave myself something special, like a new lesson, a new challenge I had to overcome. It gave my girlfriend something special, and it gave our relationship as a whole something we got to work through together. And then it was really special for me because then in January of 2019, 6 years to the date, I was back in Lima, Peru, the city that changed the course of my life. And I remember that night one of the nights we were there, Lima sits on the coast. So it's like a cliff face, but you look out over the Pacific Ocean, and the sky was just lit up all pink and purple, and the sun was as bright as I'd ever seen. And it was like saying to me, Jesse, you're on the right path. You know, it was like a full cycle close where I, like completion in my life, where I went there that one time 6 years ago, and now I'm here back, and everything has changed. I've started to really own my power to create my life. So it was really special for me. But ended up not long after that in Peru, we worked as bartenders at a hostel, and all these different opportunities came from this website called Workaway, which is like a volunteer exchange. So it was really cool to like immerse myself in different countries. So although we were in Central South America for 8 months, we only went to 3 countries, and we really got to immerse in the culture and really learn about other ways of living and like navigating life in a really authentic way, like living with locals and doing this sort of their thing, you know. After that, we went to Colombia. And Colombia just really opened my eyes for a lot of reasons personally, but the biggest impact had been on my wife, because when most people think about Colombia, even now, I want to slap them sometime, but you think about Netflix and Narcos, and people bring up recently like kidnappings, and that's just the misinformation, the propaganda, the mass media programming people to think a certain way of the world. They alter our perception of reality and prevent us from living the full experience of life. And that has never been more real than my time in Colombia. Because you get there, and I was just talking about my wife. We went out for dinner like the first night for her birthday, and she was very obviously anxious. I mean, we went to Medellin. It used to be the most dangerous city in the world. There's graffiti on the walls. There's people asking for money on the streets. You know, it's a new big city. And it's loud, and she's very obviously anxious and like very alert. And I'm like, geez, babe, like what the hell is wrong? You know? And she's no, nothing, just kind of pushing through or whatever. But it was clear that she's very anxious, and we had fine, nothing happened. But we ended up going on this walking tour. One thing we always did when we got to a new city was going on a walking tour to get like a local perspective of the city we're in. And we took this tour of Medellin, this walking tour. It's like a 3-hour tour around the city. And in that 3 hours, 5 people came up to us and said, "Welcome to Colombia. My home is your home. Thank you for coming." A dude literally ran across the street with his arms wide open, hands up in the air, and he gave me a big high five and he like yelled, "Welcome to Medellin. My home is your home. Thank you for coming." And it was that day just started a like, that was just the first day. We lived there for 2 months where we just had this constant, we felt this constant warmth from the locals. Every place we went to, we were being shown around. We were invited into back places. We were being welcomed. Like, my home is your home. And it really shifted a lot of things for my wife, especially. And not long after, like we had this experience. We were riding in these cable cars. Medellin went from being the most dangerous city in the world to the most innovative city in the world in about 20 years. And part of the reason they became the most innovative city in the world is because they created this like cable car system off these trains so they could connect the people in the poor districts, the barrios, like they lived up in the mountains, down to the city center so they can get work and they can take money back to their families, you know, so they can get out of the drugs and they can actually work for a living. And it really helped change the way Medellin lived. So you can take these cable cars, but you take them over these very poor areas where these kids have sticks and balls and dirt and people are living in some very dangerous areas, but you can ride these cable cars over them like you're at a freaking zoo, like exhibit, and you're like floating over them. You can see these people doing their laundry and stuff, kids playing soccer below. But one time we did that one time on the way to a park. And I remember on the way back from that park, after we had a great time with a bunch of local Colombians who showed us around, I remember looking at my wife and the sun was shining in on her face. And I looked over at her. She was sitting quietly looking out the window. I was like, "Babe, what are you thinking?" And she just looked right back at me dead in the eyes. And she goes, "I'm just not going to fear death anymore." And I was like, "Oh, damn. Okay. Shit is serious." You know, and it just really set into me the impact that this country has on people when you give it a chance. When you give it a chance to just step outside of what you think about the world and really go experience it for yourself. That was our time in Colombia. And ever since Colombia, I had this idea of like helping people experience this real and authentic way of seeing the world. Like, it's one thing to go to Cancun and sit in a freaking all-inclusive resort and act like you're traveling when really you're just, you're just doing the same exact stuff you would in the States in another country. It's one thing to do that versus like really go out and meet the people and see how other people are living their life and see how much it changes your life forever. Cause that's exactly what it does. So I had that idea of Bruno there, but we kept traveling. After that, we went to Europe for 8 weeks. We backpacked around Europe for 8 weeks. That was where we out for like 9 or 10 countries during that time. So that was where like 3 days from at some points, like 2 or 3 days away, we didn't know where the hell we were going to stay. We just trusted. We were just feeling this like pull. We were guided. Everything, we let go of control in our life and everything started to line up and we were exactly where we were supposed to be at all times. We ended up getting engaged in front of the Eiffel Tower in Paris, ended our trip there. And I came back. I just had this feeling. I knew I had to come home. My brother was getting very, very sick at this time, worse than he'd ever been. And again, at this point, it was 22 years. It was a constant roller coaster of ups and downs, but like it was getting weird. It was getting different. And I just knew I had to go come home. So we spent basically 10 months out of the country traveling. And at that point came home in, that would have been 2019, summer of 2019.
Yeah. And travel has such a tremendous impact on the people who take part in it. And like you said, like actually traveling and actually experiencing the cultures and not just sitting in an all-inclusive resort, right? Actually interact with the people who live in these areas and talk with them, get to know them, get to know their perspectives on things. Because I feel like so many people just, they are born in a certain area and a lot of times they don't even leave a 20-mile radius outside of where they grew up, right? For their entire lives. And, you know, it's hard to really get a perspective on the world and how other people think and act and what their culture is like when you don't leave that small bubble. I've done quite a bit of traveling myself to a lot of different parts of the world. But when you start to experience the cultures and the way people live in different areas, it opens your eyes to a whole new way of thinking, a whole new way of living, and it's really an incredible experience. And you know, for anyone who has the means to be able to do that, to be able to travel to different parts of the world. And I know anyone, you know, people who are listening to this, a lot of them are military veterans, things like that. A lot of them maybe have gone on a combat deployment. That could have a similar experience where you might interact with some of the locals, but you might also have the experience where you're trying to kill some of those people too. And that's not exactly the same kind of experience that I'm talking about. But, you know, if you have the opportunity to get out and travel, it does open your eyes to a whole new world. And there's a lot more to this world than the 20-mile radius that's just around your hometown, right? So so definitely, yeah, getting out and traveling, I think, is an incredible experience. So I want to talk about your company that you run now. It's called Action Oriented. I think I mentioned that earlier. Tell us about what you do and how you help people. I know that's been a big part of what you have set out to do with your life is to help people. You know, joining the Marines, joining the fire service, volunteer work. All this stuff is all very, very much selfless in the sense that you're out there trying to help other people. You had mentioned how you felt like you weren't helping people the way that you could when you were in the fire service. You felt like you're just kind of perpetuating these problems. But it seems like now you're out there instead of being reactive to the problems, you're being proactive and trying to help before some of this stuff gets to be a bigger issue. So tell us about what you do now and how you're helping people rebuild their lives.
Yeah, for sure. I'm gonna keep this going a little bit with some of the story because it does come in a big close. Crazy, you know, I left when I did in 2018, had no idea where I was gonna land. Landed back in Iowa for the summer of 2019. My brother did end up passing away in end of July that year or that month or yeah, 2019, that summer. So it ended up being perfect timing. It's been about after that travel, like 6 to 9 months traveling after that around the States. And then I had a plan to go to keep our traveling going. I had a month backpacking through East Africa, going to hike Kilimanjaro and do all these things, and then go to Bali and live for the summer of 2020. But then COVID kicked in and we had to cancel all our plans. We had no idea what we're going to do. We literally had like a backpack and a half to our name. And we decided to visit my dad in the town called Lakeland, Florida, right in between Orlando and Tampa. So we plopped down here to think we'd visit my dad. And a lot of things happened, but really I knew pretty much the first day that we needed to be here. I needed to be here to rebuild the relationship with my dad. I also needed to started meeting some people, one of which they became really great friends. And one of which was a man named Dan Jarvis, who has this organization called 220. And this organization has a process that is the most effective and efficient, least invasive way of dealing with trauma. So I learned about this process. I got cleared in it myself, cleared all the anger, anxiety, trauma that I experienced that wasn't taken care of before from the work that I was doing, because it gets to the neurological root of trauma. And I ended up being on a board of directors with this organization and serving as a resiliency coach. And that's what they do, is they train coaches, basically peer support, veterans, first responders, these sort of people, to step in, learn this process. It's like a 2-day training. And you can come in, you can help people. Literally, I've cleared out people with lifetime of extreme trauma in a single 90-minute session. And sometimes it takes more, like 2 to 3, to get to the things and figure out, you know. But basically, it's absolutely transformative in changing the game and trauma, which has played a big role in my life. You know, I've seen a lot of trauma, I've experienced it myself, and I know a lot of people, like our brothers and sisters, are experiencing as well. So this really clicked in and gave me a new sense of purpose, because I was doing my coaching and I was helping people overcome adversity and take action on their dreams. And it really felt amazing. But there's always something missing when someone has trauma at the root and you can't really get to it. You're like, oh, you go see a therapist, you know, but talk therapy doesn't do a damn thing to get to the subconscious root where trauma is stored. So this really clicked in and gave me a sense of purpose. I was on the board of directors, and then it was so crazy because we got a contact because of this organization with firefighters in New York City. Ended up up there working with 9/11 firefighters. And in this July of last year, I was filming in New York City for this documentary where we were working with first responders to the attacks of 9/11, a paramedic, a firefighter, and a chaplain who responded to the attacks on the World Trade Center, who had been experiencing PTSD, technically, you know, extreme anxiety and stuff. You know, people, it presents in different ways for different people, like a lot of times sleep, flashbacks, a lot of guilt, a lot of shame. Survivor's guilt is very common. These people had been experiencing this for 20 years, but we had the opportunity to be connected with them. And we went up there and filmed this documentary, worked with them. And it was so crazy because it was 20 years to the day that I was suicidal in my mom's bedroom, digging a knife into my wrist, wishing I was dead. And then the documentary was released on September 11th, 2021, the 20-year anniversary from the day that the attacks happened and the day that, you know, that moment changed my life. And I think my generation, a lot of people's lives changed that day. So there was a massive cycle close for me as far as like closing things off from my childhood. But I wanted to finish that up there, but really, I started action oriented in 2018 with coaching, with the idea of helping people one-on-one overcome adversity and take action on their dreams. And then also in that time, after I got back from my travels, that festering idea of starting this travel company was there too. So I launched Action Adventures also, and I had been hosting adventure travel and sacred medicine retreats in Colombia, where we're really helping people own their power, their purpose, and move forward to actualize their full potential in a really deep way, because there's such power, like you talked about, Scott, and experiencing that real authentic way of seeing the world and experiencing it and then overcoming the things we have to overcome and really going for it. So I was leading Action Oriented and Action Adventures during that time. And now what I'm doing is I've created a Conscious Leadership Academy, and we don't have to get into this, but I feel right now that we as veterans, as leaders of men specifically, we are being tested to the ultimate extreme right now. And I believe we have an evil force that is operating right now. And we are responsible for stepping up as leaders to become pillars of safety and strength in our family and community. And that's what I'm doing with the Leadership Accelerator. It's a 12-week mastermind group coaching experience where we work to clear out all our trauma resolution. We clear out limitations, where we get rid of limiting emotions and limiting beliefs. And we start to become these pillars. We start to become the creators of a reality, so we can really start to move forward the foundation of freedom that we need to thrive in the modern world. So I've shifted my company from action oriented from like one-on-one coaching to group coaching, specifically targeting men who want to become leaders in their community. Because right now it is red alert. We have to step up now before it's too late. So that's what I'm doing now with my with Action Oriented. And if there's a man listening to this, or a woman who knows a man that's listening to this, I encourage you to reach out, hit me up on Instagram at @action_Jesse to connect, to see if you would be a good fit for this accelerator, so we can really start to take our freedom and our power back as leaders of men during this time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will have links to your website and your Instagram on the show notes page. So anyone who's looking to get involved with this group, check the show notes out, take a look there, click through. And on your website, I believe you have like a quiz or a test or something like that to see if it's a kind of the right fit for you. So if you're reading through and you're kind of on the fence and you're not sure exactly what it's going to do for you, and or if it's even the right fit, you know, you can go through and take that quiz to see if this is going to be the right fit for you, right? So Definitely check that out. If it sounds like it's something that's interesting to you, if it sounds like it's something that you need in your life, or like you said, if there's someone that you know who might need something like that in your life, or in their life, definitely check that out. Anything else that we didn't touch on yet that you wanted to add to this? Any other kind of closing message that you might have for the listeners?
Yeah, for sure. And so the website is action-oriented.com. And like you said, Scott, thank you for bringing that up. There's a quiz called the Freedom Fighter Quiz on there. You can click on that, take a quiz. And at the end of that, you can schedule a call. You can get it right on my calendar if you're serious about this. But yeah, I mean, I would like to just specifically talk to veterans listening to this and just remind every single one of you that the end of your time in the military is not the end of your service. It's just the beginning. Life starts once you step out of your time in service and you have an opportunity to start to create a new life for yourself and for your loved ones. So really step in and fully own the experience you've had. Let go of the trauma, let go of the shame and guilt that you've experienced, and start to create your life. Because I'm serious when I say it's time we really step up. And it's time we get connected to a sense of purpose that is larger than ourselves. It's time we get connected to other men so we can be held accountable and be held into a position of integrity and really start to own our power to take our freedoms back from the entities, the people that stole it from us. So I'm just calling any veteran out and helping them realize that their time in service is not done. It's just beginning. Our time is now to really start to take our power back.
Absolutely. I think that's a great message and a good place to close out here. So, Jesse, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I really appreciated you sharing your journey all the way from your childhood through your time in the Marines, the fire service, and your travels to talk about the different experiences that you've had sharing that. I think there's people out there who maybe have had a similar situation in their life. Maybe they had a troubled childhood. They joined the military and now they're floating around. They're not really sure what to do with their lives and everything. And hearing your story is kind of inspirational to be able to realize that There is something that you can do with your life. You can turn things around. You don't have to be that victim, like you were saying before. You don't have to you don't have to be a victim in your life. You can you can turn things around. And yeah, really, you might just need that structure. You might need some guidance. And I think what you're doing now is a perfect way to do that. So the website, again, action-oriented.com. I'll have that in the show notes as well as social media. So if you want to get involved, you want to check it out, go to the show notes and check it out there. Again, Jesse, it's been great speaking with you. I'm glad that you came on. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.